Strangers would tell us stories about where they are from. He lifted his hand and motioned for the drummers to continue. During the festivities, I thought about the biggest celebration we used to have in my town at the end of the year. The women would sing about all the gossip, the dramas, the fights, and everything that had happened that year. Would they be able to sing about all that will happen by the end of this war? I thought. I also wondered a bit why the villagers were so kind to us. But I didn't dwell on these thoughts because I wanted to enjoy myself. The dance never ended that night, and we had to leave early the next day, so we left as most of the villagers slept. We carried with us a plastic gallon of water, and some smoked meat we had been given, and the old people we passed, sitting on their verandas, waiting to be warmed by the morning sun, waved and said, "May the spirit of the ancestors be with you, children." When we were walking, I turned around to see the village one last time. It was yet to be born for that day. A cock crowed to dispatch the last remains of night and to mute the crickets that couldn't let go of the darkness of their own accord. The sun was slowly rising but had already begun casting shadows on the huts and houses. I could still hear the drums echoing in my head from the previous night, but I refused to be happy. When I turned away from the village, my traveling companions were dancing in the sand, mimicking some of the dances we had seen. "Show us what you've got," they said, clapping and circling me. I couldn't refuse. I started gyrating my hips to their claps, and they joined me. We placed our hands on each other's shoulders and walked forward, dancing to sounds we made with our mouths. I was carrying the smoked meat in a small bag that I waved in the air to increase the speed at which we kicked our feet from side to side. We danced and laughed into the morning, but gradually, we stopped. It was as if we all knew that we could be happy for only a brief moment. We weren't in a hurry, so we walked slowly and quietly after we stopped dancing. At the end of the day, we had finished drinking the water we were carrying. Around nightfall, we arrived at a very peculiar village. I am in fact not sure if it was a village. There was one large house and one kitchen less than a kilometer from the house. The pots were moldy and there was a small storage house. The place was located in the middle of nowhere. "Now this will be an easy village for the rebels to capture," Juma said, laughing. We walked around trying to find a sign of someone's presence. Some sort of production of palm oil had taken place here. There were the remains of palm nut seeds everywhere. On the river floated a deserted canoe in which Spirogyra had grown. Back at the old house, we debated where to sleep. We sat outside on logs at the foot of the veranda and Musa offered to tell a story about Brass Spider. "No," we protested. We all knew it too well, but he still continued. "Brass Spider stories are always good no matter how many times you've heard them," Musa said. My mother told me that whenever a story is told, it is worth listening to. So please listen. I will tell it quickly. He coughed and began. Brass Spider lived in a village that was surrounded by many other villages. At the end of the harvest season, all the villages had a feast in celebration of their successful harvest. Wine and food were in abundance, and people ate until they could see their reflections on each other's stomach. "What?" we all said in shock at this extra detail he had added to the story. "I am telling the story so I can tell my version. Wait for your turn." Moses stood up. We listened attentively to see if he was going to embellish the story with more striking details. He sat down and continued. "Each village specialized in one dish. Brass Spider's village made okra soup with palm oil and fish. The other villages made cassava leaves with meat, potato leaves, and so on. Each village boasted about how good their meal was going to be. All the villages had an open invitation to their feast, but Brass Spider took it to the extreme. He wanted to be present at all the feasts. He had to come up with a plan. He began collecting ropes around his village and weaving them several months before the feast. While people carried bushels of rice, bundles of wood, to the square, and women pounded rice in mortars, removing the husk from its seeds, Brass Spider was stretching the ropes on his veranda and measuring their length. When men went hunting, he was busy laying out his ropes by the paths from his village to all the surrounding villages. He gave the ends of his ropes to the chiefs, who tie them to the nearest trees at their village squares. "Tell your people to pull the rope when their meal is ready," he told every chief in his nasal voice. Braspider starved for a week as he readied himself. When the day finally came, Braspider rose up earlier than everyone else. He sat on his veranda and securely tied all the ropes at his waist. He was shaking and saliva dripped out of his mouth as the smell of smoked meat, dried fish and various stews wafted out from the cooking huts. Unluckily for Braspider, all the feast started at the same time, and the chiefs ordered the ropes to be pulled. He was suspended in the air above his village, pulled from all directions. Braspider screamed for help, but the drums and songs from his village square drowned his voice. He could see people gathering around plates of food and licking their hands at the end of the meal. Children walk across the village on their way to the river, munching on pieces of stewed chicken, goat, and deer meat. Each time Braspider tried to loosen the ropes, the villagers pulled harder as they thought it was a signal that he was ready to visit their feast. At the end of the celebration in Braspider's village, a boy saw him and called on the elders. They cut the ropes and brought Braspider down. In a barely audible voice, he demanded some food, but there was nothing left. The feast had ended everywhere. Braspider remained hungry, and because he was pulled so tight for so long, this explains why spiders have a thin waistline. All this food in this story is making me hungry. Good story, though. I have never heard it told like this, Alhaji said, stretching his back. We all laughed as we knew he was mocking Musa for adding some details to the tale. As soon as Musa was done, night took over the village. It was as if the sky had quickly rolled over, changing its bright side to dark, bringing sleep with it for my companions. We placed the smoked meat and the gallon of water by the door of the room we occupied. I stayed in the room with my friends, even though I didn't fall asleep until the very last hours of the night. I remembered nights I had spent sitting with my grandmother by the fire. "You are growing up so fast. It feels like yesterday when I was at your name-giving ceremony," she would look at me, her shiny face glowing before she told me a story of my name-giving ceremony. Growing up, I had been to several of these ceremonies, but grandmother always told me about mine. Everyone in the community was present. Before things started, food was prepared in abundance with everyone's help. Early in the morning, the men slaughtered a sheep, skinned it, and shared the meat among the finest women cooks so that each would cook her best dish for the ceremony. While the women cooked, the men stood around in the yard, welcoming each other with firm handshakes, laughing, each man clearing his throat as loud as he could before he started talking. Boys who hung about and eavesdropped on the men's conversations would be called upon to perform certain tasks, slaughter chickens behind the cooking huts, chop firewood. Near the thatched roof cooking huts, women sang while they pounded rice in mortars. They did tricks with pestles. They flipped them in the air and clapped several times before they cut them and continued pounding and singing. The women who were older and more experienced not only clapped several times before they cut their pestles, but also made elaborate thank you gestures, all in harmony with the songs they sang. Inside the huts, girls sat on the ground fanning red charcoals with a bamboo fan or an old plate, or simply by blowing to start the fire under the big pots. By 9 o'clock in the morning, the food was ready. Everyone dressed up in his or her finest clothing. The women were especially elegant in their beautiful patterned cotton skirts, dresses, shirts, and lapel, a big cotton cloth that women wrapped around their waist, and extravagant head wraps. Everyone was in high spirits and ready to commence the ceremony that was to last until noon. "The imam arrived late," said my grandmother. "A large metal tray containing lewe, rice paste, color nuts, lined on the side, and water in a calabash was handed over to him. And after settling himself on a stool in the middle of the yard and rolling up the sleeves of his white gown, he mixed the lewe and separated it into several carefully molded portions, each topped with a color nut. The imam then proceeded to read several surahs from the Quran. After the prayer, he sprinkled some water on the ground to invite the spirit of the ancestors. The imam waved to my mother, motioning her to bring me to him. It was my first time outside in the open. My mother knelt before the imam and presented me to him. He rubbed some of the water from the calabash on my forehead and recited more prayers, followed by the proclamation of my name. "Ishmael he shall be called," he said. And everyone clapped. Women started singing and dancing. My mother passed me to my father, who raised me high above the crowd before passing me around to be hailed by everyone present. I had become a member of the community and was now owned and cared for by all. The food was brought out on humongous plates. The elders started to feast first, all eating from one plate. The men did the same, then the boys, before the women and girls had their share. Singing and dancing followed the feast. While the jubilation was going on, I was placed in the hands and care of older women who couldn't dance much anymore. They held me, smiled at me, and called me little husband. They started telling me stories about the community. Whenever I gave them a smile, they remarked, "He loves stories. Well, you came to the right place." I smiled a bit as I could visualize my grandmother's happy face at the end of this story. Some of my traveling companions were snoring, as the late night breeze caused my eyes to become heavy. When we woke up the next morning, all the smoked meat was gone. We started blaming each other. Kene inspected Musa's lips. Musa became angry and they started throwing blows at each other. I was about to part them when Saido pointed to the tattered bag at the edge of the veranda. "This is the bag, right?" he said, pointing to its chewed edge. "This was not done by any of us. See? The bag is still tied." He showed it to us. "Something else ate the meat, and whatever ate this meat is still around somewhere." He picked up a stick and began walking toward the bushes. "You see, it wasn't me." Musa pushed Kene out of his way as he joined Saidu. "It is some kind of animal," Moriba said, inspecting the prints the creature's feet had left on the ground. Some of us looked around the village, while others followed the tracks of the creature down the path to the river. We were about to give up looking when Saidu shouted from behind the storage house in the village, "I found a thief and he's angry." We ran to see what it was. It was a dog munching on the last bit of the smoked meat. Upon seeing us, it began barking and guarding the meat with its hind legs. "You bad dog, that is ours." Elijah took the stick from Saidu and started chasing the animal. The dog still held onto the last bit of meat as it disappeared among the bushes. With a shake of the head, Saidu picked up the gallon of water and started heading down the path. We all followed him, Elijah still holding the stick. That afternoon, we began rummaging the bushes for whatever fruit looked edible. We didn't converse much as we walked. In the evening, we stopped to rest along the path. "I should have killed that dog," Elijah said slowly, as he rode on his back. "Why?" I asked. "Yes, why? What good would it have done?" Moriba sat up. "I just wanted to kill it because it ate the only food we had," Elijah angrily replied. "It would have made good meat," Musa said. "I don't think so, plus it would have been difficult to prepare it anyway." I turned to Musa, who was lying on his back next to me. "You guys disgust me just thinking about something like that," Juma spat. "Well," Musa stood up. "He's going to tell another story," Elijah sighed. Musa turned to Elijah. "Yes, well, not really a story." He paused and then continued. "My father used to work for these Malaysians, and he told me that they ate dogs. So if Elijah had killed that dog, I would have loved to try some, so when I see my father again, I can tell him how it tasted. And he will not be angry with me because I had a good excuse for eating dog meat," Musa concluded. We all became quiet, thinking about our families. Musa had triggered in all of us what we were afraid of thinking. Musa was home with his father in Matrujong when the attack took place. His mother had gone to the market to buy fish for the evening meal. He and his father had run toward the market and found his mother, but as they ran out of town, his mother had somehow been left behind. They realized that she wasn't with them only after they stopped for a rest at the first village they reached. His father cried and told Musa to stay there while he went to look for his wife. Musa told his father that he wanted to go back down the path with him. "No, my son, stay here and I will bring back your mother." As soon as his father left, the village was attacked and Musa ran away. He had been running ever since. Alhaji was at the river fetching water when the rebels attacked. He ran home only to stand in front of the empty house shouting, the names of his parents, two brothers and sister. Kene had escaped with his parents but lost his two sisters and three brothers in the chaos. He and his parents had jumped in a boat along with many others to cross the Jong River. When the boat reached the middle of the river, the rebels on shore began shooting at the people in the boat, and everyone panicked, causing the boat to capsize. Kene swam to the other side of the river as fast as he could. When he pulled himself ashore, he could see people drowning in the water, screaming as they fought to stay afloat. The rebels laughed at the dying people. He had wept all night as he followed the survivors who made their way to a village down the river. There, people had told Kene that his parents had passed through. The hope of finding his family had kept Kene moving over the months. Juma and Moriba lived next to each other. RPGs had destroyed their houses during the attack. They had run toward the wharf to find their parents, who were traders, but their parents were nowhere to be found. They ran to the forest, where their families had earlier hidden, but they weren't there either. Saidu's family was unable to leave town during the attack, along with his parents and three sisters, who were 19, 17, and 15. He hid under the bed during the night. In the morning, the rebels broke into the house and found his parents and three sisters. Saidu had climbed to the attic to bring down the remaining rice for their journey when the rebels stormed in. Saidu sat in the attic, holding his breath and listening to the wailing of his sisters as the rebels raped them. His father shouted at them to stop, and one of the rebels hit him with the butt of his gun. Saidu's mother cried and apologized to her daughters for having brought them into this world to be victims of such madness. After the rebels had raped the sisters over and over, they bundled the family's property and made the father and mother carry it. They took the three girls with them. To this day, I carry the pain that my sisters and parents felt. When I climbed down after the rebels were gone, I couldn't stand and my tears froze in my eyes. I felt like my veins were being harshly pulled out of my body. I still feel like that all the time, as I can't stop thinking about that day. What did my sisters do to anyone? Saidu said after he was done telling us the story one night in an abandoned village. My teeth became sour as I listened to his story. It was then that I understood why he was so quiet all the time. "We should keep walking," Kene said sadly as he dusted his pants. "We had agreed to walk at night. During the day, we would search for food and take turns sleeping. At night, it felt as if we were walking with the moon. It followed us under thick clouds and waited for us at the other end of the dark forest paths. It would disappear with sunrise, but return again, hovering on our path the next night. Its brightness became dull as nights passed. Some nights the sky wept stars that quickly floated and disappeared into the darkness before our wishes could meet them. Under these stars and sky I used to hear stories, but now it seemed as if it was the sky that was telling us a story as its stars fell, violently colliding with each other. The moon hid behind clouds to avoid seeing what was happening. During the day the sun refused to rise gradually as it had before. It became bright from the minute it surfaced from behind the clouds, its golden rays darkening my eyes. The clouds in the blue sky sailed violently, destroying each other's formation. One afternoon, while we were searching for food in a deserted village, a crow fell out of the sky. It wasn't dead, but it was unable to fly. We knew this was unusual, but we needed food, and anything at that point would do. As we took the feathers off the bird, Moriba asked what day it was. We all thought about it for a while, trying to remember the name of the last day when our lives were normal. Kene broke the silence. "It is a holiday," he laughed. "You can call it any day you want," he continued. "But it is not just a day. It is a strange one. I don't feel too good about it," Musa said. "Maybe we shouldn't eat this bird." "Well now, if the falling of this bird is a sign of a curse or bad luck, we are in both. So I'm eating every bit of it. You can do as you please," Kene began humming. After Kene stopped humming, the world became eerily silent. The breeze and the clouds had stopped moving. The trees were still, as if they all awaited something unimaginable. Sometimes night has a way of speaking to us. but we almost never listened. The night after we ate the bird was too dark. There were no stars in the sky, and as we walked, it seemed as if the darkness was getting thicker. We weren't on a dense forest path, but we could barely see each other. We held onto one another's hands. We kept on walking because we couldn't stop in the middle of nowhere, even though we wanted to. After hours of walking, we came upon a bridge made of sticks. The river below was flowing quietly as if asleep. As we were about to set foot on the bridge, we heard footsteps on the other side coming toward us. We let go of one another's hand and hid in the nearby bushes. I was lying with Alhaji, Juma, and Saidu. There were three people. They were wearing white shirts. Two of them were about the same height and the third was shorter. They carried cloth under their arms. They too were holding hands, and when they stepped off the bridge, around where we lay, they stopped as if they sensed our presence. They mumbled something. It was difficult to hear what they were saying because their voices sounded like bees, as if something was obstructing their noses. After they were done mumbling, the two taller people began pulling the shorter one. One wanted them to go the way we were going, and the other insisted that they continue in the opposite direction. Their quarrel caused my heart to begin beating faster, and I was trying hard to make out their faces, but it was too dark. After about a minute, they decided to continue going in the direction we had come from. It took us a few minutes to rise from under the bushes. Everyone was breathing hard and couldn't speak. Kene began whispering our names. When he called out Saidu's name, Saidu didn't answer. We searched for him among the bushes. He was lying there quietly. We shook him hard, calling out his name, but he was silent. Alhaji and Juma began to cry. Kene and I dragged Saidu onto the path and sat by him. He was just lying there. My hands began trembling uncontrollably as we sat there throughout the night in silence. My head became heavy as I thought about what we were going to do. I do not remember who it was among us that whispered. Maybe it was the bird that we ate. Most of my travel companions began to cry, but I couldn't. I just sat there, staring into the night as if searching for something. There wasn't a gradual change between night and day. The darkness just swiftly rolled away, letting the sky shine its light on us. We were all sitting in the middle of the path. Saidu was still quiet. His forehead had residues of sweat, and his mouth was slightly open. I put my hand by his nose just to see if he was breathing. Everyone stood up, and when I removed my hand, they were all looking at me as if expecting me to say something. "I don't know," I said. They all put their hands on their heads. Their faces looked as if they wanted to hear something else, something that we knew could be possible but were afraid to accept. "What are we going to do now?" Moriba asked. "We cannot just stand here forever," Musa remarked. "We will have to carry him to the next village, however far that might be," Kene said slowly. "Help me stand him up," he continued. We stood side up, and Kene carried him on his back across the bridge. The quiet river started flowing loudly through the rocks and palm canals. As soon as we had crossed the bridge, Saidu coughed. Kene set him down and we all gathered around him. He vomited for a few minutes and wiping his mouth, he said, "Those were ghosts last night, I know it." We all agreed with him. I must have fainted after they started speaking. He tried to get up and we all aided him. "I am fine, let's go," he pushed us away. "You woke up from the dead with some attitude," Musa said. We all laughed and started walking. My hands began trembling again. I didn't know why this time. It was a gloomy day, and we kept asking Saidu if he was okay all the way to the next village. It was past midday when we arrived at a crowded village. We were shocked by how noisy it was in the middle of the war. It was the biggest village we had been to so far. It sounded like a marketplace. People were playing music and dancing, children were running around, and there was that familiar good smell of cooked cassava leaf in rich palm oil. As we walked through the village trying to find a place to sit away from the crowd, we saw some familiar faces. People hesitantly waved to us. We found a log under a mango tree and sat down. A woman whose face wasn't among the familiar ones came and sat facing us. "You," she pointed at me. "I know you," she said. I didn't know her face, but she insisted that she knew my family and me. She told me that Junior had come to the village a few weeks earlier looking for me, and that she had also seen my mother, father, and little brother in the next village, which was about 2 days' walk. She told us the direction and ended by saying, "In that village, there are lots of people from Matrujong and the Sierra Rutile mining area. All of you might be able to find your families or news about them." She got up and began dancing to the Sukus music that was playing as she left us. We all began laughing. I wanted to leave right away, but we decided to spend the night in the village. Also, we wanted Saidu to rest, even though he kept telling us that he was fine. I was so happy that my mother, father, and two brothers had somehow found one another. Perhaps my mother and father have gotten back together, I thought. We went to the river for a swim, and there we played hide-and-seek swimming games, running along the river's edge, screaming, "Cuckoo!" to commence the game. Everyone was smiling. That night, we stole a pot of rice and cassava leaves. We ate it under the coffee trees at the edge of the village, washed the pots, and returned them. We had no place to sleep, so we chose a veranda on one of the houses after everyone had gone inside. I didn't sleep that night. My hands began shaking as soon as my friends started snoring. I had a feeling that something bad was going to happen. The dogs began to cry and ran from one end of the village to the other. Alhaji woke up and sat by me. "The dogs woke me up," he said. "I couldn't sleep to begin with," I replied. "Maybe you're just anxious about seeing your family," he chuckled. "I am too." Alhaji stood up. "Don't you think it is strange the way the dogs are crying?" One dog had come near the veranda on which we sat and was vigorously crying. A few more dogs joined in. Their crying pierced my heart. "Yes, they sound very human," I said. "That is the same thing I was thinking," Alhaji yawned. "I think dogs see things we do not see. Something must be wrong," he sat down. We became quiet, just staring into the night. The dogs cried all night long, one continuing till the sky was completely clear. Babies then began to take up the cry. People started getting up, so we had to vacate the veranda. Alhaji and I began waking our friends. When he shook Saidu, Saidu was still. "Get up, we have to go now." He shook Saidu harder as we heard the people on whose veranda we had slept getting ready to come outside. "Saidu, Saidu," Kene coaxed him. "Maybe he fainted again," he said. A man came out and greeted us. He carried a small bucket of water. He had a smile on his face that told us he had known all along that we were on the veranda. "This will do it," the man sprinkled some of the cold water from his bucket on Saidu. But Saidu didn't move. He just lay on his stomach, his face buried in the dust. His palms were turned upside down and they were pale. The man turned him around and checked his pulse. Saidu's forehead was sweaty and wrinkled. His mouth was slightly opened, and there was a path of dry tears at the corners of his eyes down to his cheeks. "Do you boys know anyone in this village?" the man asked. We all said no, shaking our heads. He exhaled heavily, put his bucket down, and placed both his hands on his head. "Who is the oldest?" he asked, looking at Alhaji. Kene raised his hand. They stepped outside the veranda, and the man whispered something in his ear. Kene began to cry on the man's shoulder. It was then that we admitted that Saidu had left us. Everyone else was crying, but I couldn't cry. I felt dizzy and my eyes watered. My hands began shaking again. I felt the warmth inside my stomach, and my heart was beating slowly, but at a heavy rate. The man and Kene walked away, and when they returned, they brought with them two men who carried a wooden stretcher. They placed Saidu on it and asked us to follow them. Saidu's body was washed and prepared for burial that same day. He was wrapped in white linen and placed in a wooden coffin that was set on a table in the living room of the man whose veranda we had slept on. "Are any of you his family?" a tall, slender, muscular man asked. He was in charge of the burial ceremonies in the village. We all shook our heads, no. I felt as if we were denying Saidu, our friend, our traveling companion. He had become our family, but the man wanted a real family member who could authorize his burial. "Does any one of you know his family?" The man looked at us. "I do," Kene raised his hand. The man called him over to where he stood, on the other side of the coffin. they began talking. I tried to figure out what they were saying by reading the elaborate gestures that the man made with his right hand. His left hand was on Kenny's shoulder. Kenny's lips moved for a while, and then he began nodding until the conversation was over. Kenny came back and sat with us on the stools that were provided for the funeral service, which only we attended, along with the man on whose veranda Saidu had left us. The rest of the people in the village quietly sat on their verandas. They stood up as we walked through part of the village to the cemetery. I was in disbelief that Saidu had actually left us. I held on to the idea that he had just fainted and would get up soon. It hit me that he wasn't going to get up only after he was lowered into the hole, just in the shroud. And the diggers started covering him with the earth. What was left of him was only a memory. The glands in my throat began to hurt. I couldn't breathe well, so I opened my mouth. The man who had asked earlier if any one of us were Saidu's family began to read surahs. It was then that I began to weep quietly. I let my tears drip on the earth, and the summer dust absorbed them. The man who had carried Saidu began placing rocks around the grave to hold the mounds of earth. After the burial, we were the only ones left in the cemetery. There were mounds of earth all over. Very few had sticks with something written on them. The rest were anonymous. Saidu had just joined them. We sat in the cemetery for hours as if expecting something. But we were young. All of us were now 13, except for Kene, who was 3 years older, and our emotions were in disarray. I couldn't comprehend what or how I felt. This confusion hurt my head and made my stomach tense. We left the cemetery as night approached. It was quiet in the village. We sat outside on the log we had first sat on when we entered the village. None of us thought of going to sleep on a veranda. Kene explained to us that Saidu had to be buried, as the custom in the village was that the dead couldn't be kept overnight. It was either that or we would have had to take Saidu out of the village. No one responded to Kenny. He stopped talking and the dogs began to cry again. They did all night until we became restless. We walked up and down the village. Most people weren't asleep. We could hear them whispering when the dogs took breaks or went to cry on opposite ends of the village. I remembered a few weeks back when Saidu had spoken about parts of him slowly dying each passing day as we carried on with our journey. Perhaps all of him had died that night when he spoke in that strange voice after we had survived that attack by men with machetes, axes, and spears, I thought. My hands and feet began to shake, and they continued to do so throughout the night. I was worried and kept calling out my friends' names so that they wouldn't fall asleep. I was afraid if any did, he was going to leave us. Early in the morning, Kene told us that we were going to leave after sunrise and head for the next village. I can't stand another night listening to these dogs. They terrify me, he said. That morning, we thanked the man who had helped bury Saidu. You will always know where he is laid, one of the men said. I nodded in agreement, but I knew that the chances of coming back to the village were slim, as we had no control over our future. We knew only how to survive. As we left the village, everyone lined up to watch us go. I was scared, as this reminded me of when we walked through the village with Saidu's body. We went by the cemetery, which was at the edge of town, by the path that led to where we hoped to reunite with our families. The sun penetrated the graveyard, and as we stood there, a slight breeze blew, causing the trees surrounding the mounds of earth to sway gracefully. I felt a chill at the back of my neck, as if someone were softly blowing on me. A strand of smoke was rising from the village, making its way to the sky. I watched as it disappeared. We were leaving our friend, or as my grandmother would put it, his temporary journey in this world had ended. We, on the other hand, had to continue. When we started to walk away, we all began to sob. The cockcrows faded, only to make us aware of our silence, the silence that asked who will be next to leave us. The question was in our eyes when we looked at each other. We walked fast as if trying to stay in the daytime, afraid that nightfall would turn over the uncertain pages of our lives. Chapter 11. We had been walking in silence through the night until we stopped to listen to the singing of morning birds, shattering the silence of the day. As we sat on the side of the path, Moriba began to sob. He was sitting away from us, something he usually did with Saidu. He played with a piece of branch, trying to distract himself from what he was feeling. Everyone except me started to sob and moved next to Moriba, who was now crying loudly. I sat by myself, covering my face with the palms of my hands to hold back my tears. After a few minutes, my friend stopped crying. We continued on without saying a word to each other. We all knew that we could grieve only for a short while in order to continue staying alive. I look forward to getting to this village. Ah, I will give my mother a very tight hug. Alhaji smiled and then continued. She always complains, though, when I give her a tight hug. If you love me, stop squeezing my old bones so I can be alive longer. She's funny. We giggled. I have a feeling that we will find our families, or at least news of them. Kenny stretched his hands as if trying to catch the sun. He looked at Alhaji, who was smiling uncontrollably. I heard you have a beautiful sister. I am still just your friend, right? We all started laughing. Alhaji jumped on Kenny's back and they began to wrestle in the grass. When they were done, they followed us on the path, singing one of S.E. Rogers' songs. No look me by the eye, no way me like that. We joined in and sang as if we were having one of life's most glorious moments. But slowly, silence returned and took over. One side of the sky was completely blue and the other was filled with stagnant clouds. The quiet breeze caused the branch to snap in the forest. The echo sounded like a cry, a wailing. I wasn't the only one who noticed it, because my friend stopped briefly and listened attentively. The breeze picked up its pace. The leaves of the trees began to rub against each other, resisting the wind. More branches snapped in the forest and the wailing intensified. The trees looked as if they were in pain. They swayed in all directions and slapped each other with their branches. The clouds rolled over the blue sky and it became dark. A heavy rain followed, with thunder and lightning that lasted for less than 15 minutes. Afterward, the sky returned to its bluest. I walked, perplexed, in my soaked clothes, under the sun. At night, it began to rain again. The strands of rain fell brutally from the sky, whipping us. We walked for most of the night, wiping the water off our faces in order to see. It became unbearable to continue, so we sat at the foot of huge trees and waited. Whenever the lightning lit the forest, I could see where everyone was sitting. We all had our faces resting on our knees and our arms were crossed. The last hours of the night were long. By the time the rain stopped, it was light. We were all shivering, our fingertips pale and wrinkled. We look like soaked chickens, Musa said, laughing as we emerged from under the trees. We found an opening where the sun had begun penetrating, and we squeezed and spread our shirts on the tops of the bushes and sat in the sun to dry ourselves. It was almost midday when we put on our damp clothes and continued walking. A few hours later, we heard a cock crow in the distance. Musa jumped in the air and we all began to laugh. Finally, we were approaching the village where seeing our families was actually a possibility. I couldn't stop smiling. Coffee trees began to replace forest, and footprints appeared on the path. We heard rice being pounded and whispers in the breeze. We quickened our pace as these sounds assured us that life was ahead. On the opposite side of the coffee farm was a small banana farm. And there we came across a man cutting down hands of ripe banana. We couldn't see his face as his head was behind the leaves. Good afternoon, Kene said. The man peeped at us from behind a banana leaf. He wiped the sweat off his forehead and walked toward us. As he approached, slowly making his way through the noisy dry banana leaves, the sight of his face awakened my memory. His face was a little wrinkled now and he was much skinnier than when I had last seen him. His name was Gasimu. Ngo Gasimu. He used to be one of the notorious single men in my town. Back then, everyone talked about him not being married. the older people always remarked. He is old enough and responsible enough to find a good wife, but he likes to be alone. He likes that loose life. He never said anything back then and didn't get upset by what they said. He cooked his own food, and when he was too tired to cook, he ate gari, a grated and dried food made from cassava with honey. There was a period of time when he ate gari with honey for over a week. My mother decided to dish him out a plate every evening. "That food is unhealthy for you," she had said to him, and he smiled, rubbing his head. When Gassimu was by the path, he stopped and examined our faces. He smiled, and that was when I became sure that he was the Ngogassimu I knew, because he was missing a front tooth. "You boys want to help me carry some bananas to the village?" he asked, in that manner that adults usually ask young people, so that we knew he wouldn't take no for an answer. "Come on, boys," he motioned for us to follow him into the banana farm. All of us started walking past him as he continued waving his hand as if he was pulling us with an invisible rope. When I approached him, he put his hand on my shoulder and rubbed my head. "Are you still a troublesome boy?" he pulled on my nose. "There is no time to be troublesome these days," I said. "I see that you look very sad. Your forehead used to glow naturally when you were just a child. Your parents and I used to discuss how unusual that was. We thought it was because you were happy all the time. Your mother said you even smiled while you slept. But when you started your troublesomeness and were angry, your forehead glowed even more. We didn't have any other explanations for your forehead and how it related to your character. And here you are. It isn't shining anymore." He paused for a moment, looking at me. He walked away and began instructing my traveling companions how to pick up a hand of bananas and carry it on their shoulders instead of their heads. "This way you won't break them in half," he explained. I picked up some of the bananas and waited for Gassimu to gather his water jug, machete, and the last bunch. "So how did you get—" I started, but he interrupted. "Your parents and brothers will be happy to see you. They have been talking about you every day and praying for your safety. Your mother cries every day, begging the gods and ancestors to return you to her. Your older brother left to look for you, but he returned about a week ago. His face was sad when he returned. I think he blames himself for losing you." I dropped the hand as he started giving me this news. He continued walking, so I quickly picked up the bananas and followed him. "They will indeed be surprised to see you." He walked slowly in front of me. I was breathing fast and couldn't bring out a word. I wanted to drop the hand and run as fast as I could to the village. My eyelids were twitching, and I felt as if the breeze was passing through my brain. It made me feel lightheaded. Excitement and sadness made me feel as if my heart would explode if I waited any longer. But on such a narrow path, I couldn't walk past all those in front of me. After a few minutes, we came to a river, and I was happy, because at the edge of most villages there was a river, so I thought we should be there any minute now, but we weren't yet. "The village is just over the hill," Gassimu said. It was a long hill with rocks on either side of the path and some unmovable ones that the roadmakers had left in the middle. The path zigzagged up to the top, where, when we finally made it, everyone had to rest for a few minutes. I became angry that we had to rest, and I sat on a big rock away from the group. My eyes followed the brown, dusty path that continued down the hill to the thick forest, through which I caught a glimpse of the thatch and tin roofs of the village. Part of me was on the way to the village, the other impatiently waited on the hill. Gassimu passed around his jug of water, which I refused. When it got back to him, we picked up the banana hands and started down the hill. I started before everyone else so that I could walk fast and be in the front. As I was going down the hill, I heard gunshots and dogs barking and people screaming and crying. We dropped the bananas and began running in order to avoid the open hillside. A thick smoke started rising from the village. At the top of it, sparks of flame leapt into the air. We hid in the nearby bushes and listened to gunshots and the screams of men, women, and children. The children wailed, men screamed at high pitches that pierced through the forest and covered the shrieks of women. The gunshots finally ceased, and the world was very quiet, as if listening. I told Gassimo that I wanted to go to the village. He held me back, but I shoved him away into the bushes and ran down the path as fast as I could. I didn't feel my legs. When I got to the village, it was completely on fire, and bullet shells covered the ground like mango leaves in the morning. I did not know where to begin looking for my family. Gassimo and my friends had followed me, and we all stood looking at the flaming village. I was sweating because of the heat, but I wasn't afraid to run in between the houses. Nails were popping off tin roofs, and they flew, landing on nearby thatched roofs, increasing the wrath of the fire. As we were watching the flaming tin roof in flight, we heard screams and loud banging a few houses away. We ran behind the houses at the edge of the coffee trees and came upon the house where the cries were coming from. There were people locked in it. The fire was already too much inside. It showed its face through the windows and the roof. We picked up a mortar and banged the door open, but it was too late. Only two people came out, a woman and a young child. They were on fire and ran up and down the village, slamming themselves against everything in their way and going back in the other direction to do the same. The woman fell and stopped moving. The child gave a loud screech and sat next to a tree. He stopped moving. It all happened so fast that we just stood there, rooted to the ground. The child's yelp was still echoing in my head, as if it had taken on a life of its own inside me. Gassimo had wandered away from where I stood. He began screaming from another side of the village. We ran to where he was. More than 20 people lay face down in the earth. They were all lined up, and blood still poured out of their bullet wounds. A stream of it had begun running along the ground, making its way under each body, as if joining them together. Gassimo's sobs grew louder as he turned each body over. Some of their mouths and eyes were open in shapes that showed how much they had cringed as they waited for the bullet from behind. Some had inhaled dirt, perhaps while taking their last breath. The bodies were mostly men in their late and early 20s. A few were younger. On other parts of the village were the half-burnt remains of those who had fought fiercely to free themselves, only to die outside. They lay on the ground in different postures of pain, some reaching for their heads, the white bones in their jaws visible, others curled up like a child in a womb, frozen. The fire had begun to die down, and I was running around the village looking for something, something I did not want to see. I hesitantly tried to make out the faces of burnt bodies, but it was impossible to tell who they had been. Besides, there were too many of them. They stayed in that house. Gassimo said to me as he pointed toward one of the charred houses. The fire had consumed all the door and the window frames, and the mud that had been pushed in between the sticks was falling off, revealing the ropes through which the remaining fire was making its way. My entire body went into shock. Only my eyes moved, slowly opening and closing. I tried to shake my legs to get my blood flowing, but I fell to the ground, holding my face. On the ground, I felt as if my eyes were growing too big for their sockets. I could feel them expanding, and the pain released my body from the shock. I ran toward the house. Without any fear, I went inside and looked around the smoke-filled rooms. The floors were filled with heaps of ashes. No solid form of a body was inside. I screamed at the top of my lungs and began to cry as loud as I could, punching and kicking with all my might into the weak walls that continued to burn. I had lost my sense of touch. My hands and feet punched and kicked the burning walls, but I couldn't feel a thing. Gassimo and the rest of the other boys began pulling me away from the house. I kept kicking and punching as they dragged me out. I have looked around for them, but I can't see them anywhere, Gassimo said. I was sitting on the ground with my legs spread in the dirt, holding my head in my hands. I was filled up with anger. I hissed and boiled, and my heart felt as if it was going to explode. At the same time, I felt as if something had literally been placed on my head, heavier than I could ever imagine, and my neck was beginning to ache. If we hadn't stopped to rest on that hill, if we hadn't run into Gassimo, I would have seen my family, I thought. My head was burning as if on fire. I put my hands on both ears and squeezed them in vain. I didn't know what was happening to me. I got up, walked behind Gassimo, and locked his neck under my arms. I squeezed him as hard as I could. "I can't breathe," he said, fighting back. He pushed me off, and I fell next to a pestle. I picked it up and hit Gassimo with it. He fell, and when he got up, his nose was bleeding. My friends held me back. Gassimo looked at me and said sadly, "I didn't know this was going to happen." He walked toward a mango tree and sat by it, wiping the blood falling from his nose. My friends had pinned me to the ground and were vehemently arguing. Some said it was Gassimo's fault that we didn't get to see our parents. Others said it wasn't, and that if it hadn't been for him, we would all be dead. I didn't care. I wanted to see my family, even if it meant dying with them. My friends started fighting amongst themselves, kicking, punching, throwing each other to the ground. Alhaji pushed Juma into one of the houses and his pants caught on fire. He screamed as he rolled in the dirt, slapping the fire off. When Juma got up, he picked up a stone and threw it at Alhaji. It hit Alhaji on the back of his head. Blood ran down his neck. When Alhaji saw his blood, he became furious and ran toward Juma, but Gassimo intervened. He put Alhaji away and tied his bleeding head with a piece of cloth. We were all quiet and angry, in the ruins of the village, where it seemed our journey had ended. "None of this is anyone's fault," Gassimo said slowly. His words made me angry, and I wanted to rush him again, but we heard loud voices of people approaching the village. We ran into the nearby coffee farm and lay in the dirt watching the village. A group of more than 10 rebels walked into the village. They were laughing and giving each other high fives. Two looked slightly older than me. They had blood on their clothes, and one of them carried the head of a man, which he held by the hair. The head looked as if it was still feeling its hair being pulled. Blood dripped from where the neck had once been. The other rebel carried a gallon of gasoline and a big box of matches. The rebels sat on the ground and started playing cards, smoking marijuana, and boasting about what they had done that day. "We burned about 3 villages today." One skinny guy, who was perhaps enjoying himself more than everyone else, laughed. Another rebel, the only one dressed in full army gear, agreed with him. "Yes, 3 is impressive in just a few hours in the afternoon." He paused, playing with the side of his G3 weapon. "I especially enjoyed burning this village. We caught everyone here. No one escaped. That is how good it was. We carry out the command and executed everyone. Commander will be pleased when he gets here." He nodded, looking at the rest of the rebels, who had stopped the game to listen to him. They all agreed with him, nodding their heads. They gave each other high fives and resumed their game. "Some people escaped in the other 2 villages," the other rebel, who was standing up, said. He paused, rubbing his forehead as if pondering why that had happened, and then continued. "They probably saw the smoke from this village and knew something was happening. We should change our strategy. Next time we must attack all the villages at the same time." The others didn't pay him as much attention as they did when the rebel dressed in the army suit spoke. The rebels went on with their card games, chatting for hours, and then for no apparent reason, they shot a couple of rounds into the air. Someone in my group moved and the dried coffee leaves made some noise. The rebels stopped playing their game and ran in different directions to take cover. 2 started walking towards us, aiming their guns. They walked fast and then crouched. As if planned, we all got up and started running. Bullets followed us out of the coffee farm and into the forest. Gassimo was in front and he knew where he was going. We all followed him. When we reached the forest's edge, Gassimo stopped and waited for us to catch up. "Follow the path straight," he told us. When I reached him, he tried to smile at me. I do not know why, but it made me angrier. I ran past him and followed the narrow path on which grass had grown. I was behind Alhaji, who parted the bushes like a diver heading to the surface for air. Some of the bushes slapped me, but I didn't stop. The gunshots grew louder behind us. We ran for hours, deeper into the forest. The path had ended, but we kept running until the sky swallowed the sun and gave birth to the moon. The bullets continued to fly behind us, but now their redness could be seen as they pierced through the bushes. The moon disappeared and took the stars with it, making the sky weep. Its tears saved us from the red bullets. We spent the night breathing heavily under the bushes, soaked with rain. The hunters had given up. Gassimo began to cry like a child. It always made me afraid when such things happen. In my younger years, I learned that grown men cry only when they have no other choice. Gassimo rolled on the ground in pain. When we finally summoned the courage to pick him up, we found out why he was crying. He had been shot sometime as we ran away the previous night. His right leg was bleeding and had begun to swell. He was holding his side and didn't want to remove his hand. Alhaji lifted Gassimo's hand. His side was bleeding as well. It was as if his hand had been holding his blood from flowing. It rushed out of him like water breaking banks. He began to sweat. Alhaji asked me to contain the blood by placing my hand on Gassimo's side. I did, but his blood continued to slip through my fingers. He looked at me, his eyes sadly beginning to sink deeper into their sockets. He managed to raise his weak right hand to hold the wrist of my hand that was on his side. He had stopped sobbing, even though tears still ran down his eyes, but not as much as the blood that he was losing. Musa couldn't bear the sight of blood any longer. He fainted. Alhaji and I took Gassimo's shirt off and tied it around his side to contain his blood. The rest of our companions watched with tense faces. Musa woke up and joined them. In between Gassimo's gasps, he told us that there was a wali, a place outside villages where people process coffee or other crops, nearby, and that if we went back toward the farm, he would show us how to rejoin the path and get to it. We had taken the wrong turn during the night. Gassimo put his arms around my shoulder and Alhaji's. We lifted him up and began walking slowly through the bushes. We set him down every few minutes and wiped his sweaty forehead. It was past midday when Gassimo began heaving, his entire body shaking. He asked us to set him down. He held his stomach and began to roll in pain from one side to the other. His heaving increased and he stopped rolling. He lay flat on his back, staring at the sky. His eyes were fixed on something and his legs vibrated and stopped. His hands did the same, and then finally his fingers, but his eyes remained opened, transfixed, on the top of the forest. "Let's pick him up," Alhaji's voice was shaking. I put Gassimo's arm around my neck. Alhaji did the same, and we walked with him, his feet dragging on the ground. His arms were cold. His body was still sweating, and he continued bleeding. We didn't say a word to each other. We all knew what had happened. When we finally got to the wali, Gassimo's eyes were still open. Alhaji closed them. I sat by him. His blood was on my palm and my wrist. I regretted hitting him with a pestle. The dry blood was still in his nose. I began to cry softly. I couldn't cry as much as I wanted to. The sun was getting ready to leave the sky. It had come out to take Gassimo with it. I just sat by him, unable to think. My face began to harden. When the breeze blew against it, I felt how my flesh resisted and joined the cool wind. All through the night, no sleep came to me. My eyes watered and dried over and over again. I did not know what to say. For a few minutes, I tried to imagine what it felt like for Gassimo when his fingers vibrated to let the last air out of his body. Chapter 12. We must have been walking for days. I do not really remember. When suddenly two men put us at gunpoint and motioned with their guns for us to come closer, we walked in between two rows of men carrying machine guns, AK-47s, G3s, and RPGs. Their faces were dark, as if they had bathed them in charcoal, and they stared intensely at us with their extremely red eyes. When we got to the back of the line, there were four men lying on the ground, their uniforms soaked with blood. One of them lay on his stomach and his eyes were wide open and still. His insides were spilling out onto the ground. I turned away and my eyes caught the smashed head of another man. Something inside his brain was still pulsating and he was breathing. I felt nauseated. Everything began to spin around me. one of the soldiers was looking at me, chewing something and smiling. He took a drink from his water bottle and threw the remaining water at my face. "You will get used to it. Everybody does eventually," he said. Gunshots erupted nearby and the soldiers began to move, taking the six of us with them. We came upon a river where the soldiers' aluminum boats, with mortars, gently floated. We saw bodies of 11 and 13-year-old boys in army shorts piled by the river. We turned our faces away. The gunshots were getting louder. As we climbed into the boats, an RPG flew from the bushes, exploding on the shore. The top of the river was boiling. A man in army trousers came running down the path toward the boats, shooting at the soldiers. One of the men in my boat opened fire, dropping the man on the ground. The boats headed downstream, and we were led off near a tributary. A soldier led us to Yile, a village that was occupied by the military. It was a big village with more than 10 houses. The soldiers occupied most of them. They had cut down the bush around the village, except for the entrance from the river through which we arrived. This way, the soldier explained to us, it would be difficult for the enemy to attack. In the beginning, it seemed we had finally found safety at Yile. The village was always full of lively chattering and laughter. The adults, civilians and soldiers, spoke about the weather, planting seasons, hunting, and nothing about the war. At first, we couldn't understand why people behaved this way, but gradually the smiles on people's faces assured us that there was nothing to worry about anymore. All that darkened the mood of the village was the sight of orphaned children. There were over 30 boys between the ages of 7 and 16. I was one of them. Apart from this, there was no indication that our childhood was threatened, much less that we would be robbed of it. We stayed in a big, unfinished cement brick house along with other boys. A large green top served as its roof, and we slept on the cement floor on tiny blankets that two people shared. The soldiers set up their garrison in another unfinished brick house, and there they socialized separate from the civilians. In the evenings, they watched movies, played music, laughed, and smoked marijuana. The smell of it covered the entire village. During the day, they mingled with the civilians and we helped in the kitchen. Kenny and I fetched water and washed dishes. The rest of our friends helped by chopping eggplants, onions, meats, and the like in the kitchen. I liked busying myself with work all day, going back and forth to the river, and continuously washing dishes. It was the only way I could distract myself from the thoughts that were giving me severe headaches. But by midday, all the daily chores were done. The evening meal was prepared and only awaited consumption. Everyone sat on the verandas of the houses facing the village square. Parents picked their children's hair. Girls played singing and clapping games, and some of the young soldiers played soccer with the boys. Their jubilation and clapping could be heard far down the river. Life was not lived in fear during the day in this village. The soccer games reminded me of the league matches I used to play in when my family first moved to the mining town of Mogbemo. In particular, I remember the final match that my team, which consisted of Junior and some friends, won. Both my parents were at the game, and at the end, my mother applauded and smiled widely. Her face glowed with pride. My father walked up to me and rubbed my head before he held my right hand and raised it up as he declared me his champion. He did the same to Junior. My mother brought us a cup of water, and as we drank, she fanned us with her head cloth. The excitement caused my heart to pound faster and I was sweating profusely. I could taste the salty sweat that ran from my forehead to my lips. Standing there with my family, I felt light, as if I was getting ready to fly. I wanted to hold the moment longer, not only to celebrate our victory, but because the smile on my parents' faces that evening made me so happy that I felt every nerve in my body had awoken and swayed to the gentlest wind that sailed within me. I distanced myself from games in the village and sat behind houses, staring into the open space until my migraines temporarily subsided. I didn't tell anyone what was happening to me. My symptoms were mentioned in the morning when the sergeant doctor, as the civilians called him, lined up children and families for treatment. The sergeant doctor called for fever, cold, and many other illnesses, but he never asked if anyone was having nightmares or migraines. At night, Alhaji, Juma, Moriba, and Kene played marbles on the cement floor under the moonlight that made its way through the open window panes. Musa had grown popular among the boys and would always end the night with a different story. I quietly sat in the corner of the room, clenching my teeth as I didn't want to show my friends the pain I felt from my headache. In my mind's eye, I would see sparks of flame, flashes of scenes I had witnessed, and the agonizing voices of children and women would come alive in my head. I cried quietly as my head beat like the clapper of a bell. Sometimes after the migraines had stopped, I was able to fall asleep briefly, only to be awoken by nightmares. One night, I dreamt that I was shot in the head. I was lying in my blood as people hurriedly walked past me. A dog came by and began licking my blood ferociously. The dog bared its teeth as my blood sweetened its mouth. I wanted to scare it away, but I was unable to move. I woke up before it started what I was afraid it was going to do to me. I was sweating and couldn't sleep for the rest of the night. One morning, the atmosphere in the village suddenly became tense. It wasn't clear what had caused the change, but something was about to happen. All the soldiers